The PC gave us computing power at home, the internet connected us, and mobile let us do it pretty much anywhere. Now generative AI lets us communicate with technology in our own language using our own senses. But figuring it all out when you're living through it is a totally different story. Welcome to Leading the Shift, a new podcast from Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. In each episode, leaders will share what they're learning to help you navigate all this change with confidence. Please join us. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
I'm Kusha Navadar.
And this is Climate One. Kusha, I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm somewhat of a slow adopter of technology. I had the same smartphone for about 10 years, and I only recently replaced it because nobody would support the operating system anymore. But the phone still worked.
You must have had one hell of a phone case. You don't try to get a new phone every couple of years?
No, not really. And so, you know, I don't think I've been as captivated by the release of artificial intelligence programs like ChatGPT as many other people have. But that said, I'm aware artificial intelligence is ubiquitous in all of our lives. I mean, we use it nearly every day. In many capacities, I use it editing this program. And, you know, it transcribes interviews much faster than a human could. And in the last few years, those transcriptions have gotten much more accurate.
Yeah, I feel like there was this boiling point a couple of years ago where this technology just like took off. I remember back in 2017, when I was living in DC as a speechwriter, I was sitting at my kitchen table with my roommate and our mutual friend. So it's like the three of us sitting around a table. And Ariana, I kid you not, I said, I think I should start a business that uses AI to write speeches, because I feel like in 10 years, that technology is like going to be present everywhere. And Ariana, I was wrong. It didn't take 10 years. It took five. And that just really underscores how fast this transformation happens.
Yeah, and obviously you're a visionary, so when you have another idea, follow it.
So thanks.
But you're right about the speed. It really seems like there's been kind of this overnight shift, and we're going to talk a lot on today's show about how all that ramped up computing power requires a ton of electrical power. So in the past, we've talked about how shuttered coal-fired power plants have been rebooted to run cryptocurrency operations. There's something similar happening with AI. We've seen companies like Microsoft walk back some of their ambitious climate goals because they see the money that can be made from their booming AI sector.
And some of these same companies are exploring nuclear power as a way to provide what's known as firm carbon-free power to run some of these plants. Firm here means that it's always on compared to something else like wind or solar.
You know, and even being somewhat of a Luddite myself, I know that in spite of the power demands and these other environmental impacts from artificial intelligence, it also has some really clear climate benefits. It's made it possible for satellites to detect methane leaks that we didn't know about, and it can generate faster, cheaper, and much more accurate weather forecasts.
Yeah, and AI is not all one thing. I think that's a really important point to make here. It's not all coming from one company. It's not all about like generating weird images to post on the internet. So yes, AI can do good things, hot take. And the power demands and server farms needed to fuel that artificial intelligence have real world impacts.
One place familiar with this is Southwest Memphis, where Elon Musk's company xAI set up shop practically overnight, to the surprise of many local residents. I talked with Keyshawn Pearson, executive director of Memphis Community Against Pollution, about how this has affected the place where he grew up.
Where I grew up is a place, heavy Black population, beautiful Black people. And our community was one where people care for one another and really chose to treat one another like family. There was never a place that I felt like I was othered or felt like I wasn't around people who cared about my genuine well-being. Whether I was at school, whether I was at Mount Pisgah Baptist Church, or I was at the corner store, my grandmother Pearson, I felt like she knew everybody. The way that folks would come up and greet her every time we were out. And even my grandmother, Gwendolyn Griffin, she would take us everywhere. But one of the places she took us often was like to the bank, because we could get candy. And, you know, it just always felt like whether it was the grocery store, whether it was the bank, whether it was T.L. Fuller Park, where we had our family reunions and everybody else had theirs too. It felt like it was just one big family environment and you just felt safe and you felt like you were cared for because, you know, if you did something wrong and an adult was around, you was in trouble no matter who it was, right?
Somebody didn't catch you.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It is beautiful. Westwood is a beautiful place in South Memphis.
And hearing you describe the community, how tight-knit and loving and generous, is really beautiful. It really sounds like a wonderful place to grow up. And I also want people listening to know, just for context, that this part of Memphis also is close to a lot of industrial development, right? And that contributes to poor air quality and some negative things that come with being in this part of the city.
That's right. And so while the community is very strong and was very strong growing up, one of the things that never escaped me was the smells, you know, whether we were, you know, just out in the field playing football or even when we were on trips to the grocery store, you know, there would be an odor. And, you know, the simple understanding that I had was that, you know, this is just, you know, how things are, right? That happens sometimes and you keep moving forward. And the other thing I remember is just being in the shadow of smokestacks. If you go to Southwest Memphis, if you go to Westwood, the thing that you see is not, you know, the lush trees that are in T.L. Fuller Park. You don't see a big sign that says Westwood and welcome to, you know, our community. It's literally an oil refinery and it's smokestacks, you know, so you see smoke, you see fire, and these huge metal objects that are so foreign, right, and so different from what you are used to seeing on an everyday basis. And I think for me, I just got used to seeing it, right? And unfortunately, it wasn't until I got, you know, into my teenage years that I realized, you know, that when I did travel further out into, you know, majority white areas or more affluent areas, there were no smokestacks. There were no oil refineries there, right? There was no odor. And so that actually started to kind of mean something to me because I start to realize that, you know, where I'm from is different from other places and other people see it as bad. That is something that I've always wanted to change perceptually. Where I'm from isn't bad, right? It's not less than, it's not a place where people are any different. We still want the same thing.
Yeah.
We want to live, grow, play, and have an environment that's safe and healthy, just like everybody else.
Yeah. We've talked with your brother, Justin J. Pearson, Tennessee State Representative, on the show.
Yeah.
And we talked about the efforts that you and he put forward fighting the Byhalia pipeline, which was going to be routed through that part of Memphis. And that fight resolved well. You all were able to defeat that part of the pipeline not coming through your neighborhood.
That's right.
And now there's another challenge. Elon Musk has come to town and his XAI company has built a massive data center in this part of Memphis called Colossus. So how did you first hear about this project?
I literally first heard about this project sitting with the mayor of the city of Memphis as we talked about plans to make Memphis more environmentally sustainable. At the conclusion of that meeting, the mayor told me and the folks who were present, Elon Musk is building a facility in South Memphis. I don't know much more than that, but that is what's happening. And there is a different type of disappointment that you feel when you have sacrificed so much in order to protect your community, protect your family, honestly, and be presented yet again the fact that where you live, the place that your family has been for generations, is again a target of environmental racism. And I asked about the pollution immediately, right? Because that is my key concern, is what type of pollution is going to be attached to this project?
Mm-hmm.
Because I know where you're saying it's going to be placed, right? And I know why people continue to select us, and they continue to put facilities in this area, because they can continue to get away with policy murder, right? It's signed on the dotted line, and they can move forward and continue to kill people. And so for me, my heart is racing, and I've asked the question, and he doesn't have an answer, right? A clear answer, and says that, you know, he doesn't have all the answers, but he wants to get them. That may have been even more frustrating to learn that all of the precautions to protect us weren't already taken before this announcement, right? And so blindsided, frustrated, and just really disappointed that at this moment, after the defeat of the Byhalia pipeline, right, after the defeat of Sterilization Services of Tennessee, we then have one of the most notorious environmental dangers in our backyard. Following that conversation, I got with Latricia Adams, the CEO and founder of Young, Gifted, and Green, Sarah Houston, executive director of Protect Our Aquifer, and we drafted a press release that elevated the concerns of the community. When we looked at what this data center could possibly look like based on the size of the facility that they wanted to use, we immediately saw that they would need an absorbent amount of power, for one. And that was a huge question, because MLGW, Memphis Light, Gas, and Water, who provides our power, they struggle already. It could be a beautiful day out, and you can lose power. And so how are we going to bring in, you know, such a mega absorption site of energy and be able to keep our grid sustainable, right? We already were lacking in resilience.
Yeah, and there's some really unsettling parts of how this came about, how few people were informed, even city council, how few of them were involved in any of this decision making before this approval was granted. And turning to this question of power usage, we know data centers require a tremendous amount of power, as you said. The local utility says this facility is going to need about 150 megawatts of electricity. That's enough to power 100,000 homes per year. And in a statement of its own, the utility says it has enough water and enough power, enough gas to supply Colossus without impacting other users. And so what's your response to that?
That is selling a dream, right? Because we don't have the resiliency that we need. This same utility company has lobbied our city council and their own board at Memphis Light, Gas, and Water to raise the rates for the ratepayers in order to pay for improvements that they are consistently lacking, right? This is proven by what they've already admitted to. Now, the other organization that has to be mentioned here is the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Mm-hmm.
The Tennessee Valley Authority also released a statement saying that our power grid is not as resilient as it should be, and that there is no way we can handle the growing demand, right? And so to say that TVA, who supplies MLGW their power, doesn't have that same faith is something that we have to pay attention to, because, again, it is providing this magical thinking that is harmful to our community, because we are the ones who suffer. We are the ones who get the notifications that say you have to, you know, turn down your water use or your power use and conserve energy. You, the ratepayers, the people, right? Not the corporations, the people have to suffer and make those sacrifices. But we will sell this magical thinking propaganda that we can continue to absorb more and more power demand. And that is dangerous for us, but it's just unsettling to know that folks can really say whatever to attract these companies. And then we are trapped with the longevity of the situation.
And just to underscore or recap what you said, Tennessee Valley Authority, this gigantic utility, is saying we don't have enough bandwidth, basically, to give you the power you need. So for the meantime, Colossus is being powered by mobile methane gas power plants. So they're not even using the grid right now. They're waiting on that. What's the impact of all of these gas turbines burning locally in Shelby County, which already has an F in air quality, and sort of globally as well?
So the power that they're using are methane gas turbines, right? Methane itself is a greenhouse gas, and we know that that warms our planet. The other byproducts of burning methane gas are formaldehyde, nitrogen oxide, chemicals that we know create smog in our air, and that goes into the lungs of the people who breathe it and causes all types of respiratory issues. Now, you're suffocating people to run a machine, right? And you're doing this at this exacerbated rate. You're moving super fast. The announcement was June 5th. They have these turbines up and running by the end of June, and they start polluting with no permits. Why is anyone able to move this fast and cause this much damage? Now, the Shelby County Health Department is who oversees our air pollution control, right? And that's who we are counting on to protect us. June happens. We get no word. July, August, nothing, right? The only statement that they make says that they are reaching out to the EPA for guidance. And so it is our public institutions practicing what I believe is this learned helplessness. And instead of doing what it takes to protect us, doing what it takes to say, this project has to shut down until you pass the right regulations, right? Until you check the right boxes, until we know that this is safe for our community.
This Colossus plant was put together very quickly, came online very quickly, as you've said. And it's not planning to stay small either, right? There are plans for further expansion. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah. So this facility, 100,000 GPUs, graphic processing units, right? To train this model for the data that is supposed to process. In December, they announced that they wanted to 10 times that to a million. And my thinking is, you're going to do 10 times the pollution? You need 10 times that power? 10 times. And so how is that going to happen when just months ago, we got notices to conserve power as a community? And we know for a fact we haven't had the infrastructure built for this. And so how much more pollution is it that we have to breathe in? How much more pollution is it that we have to take or accept until somebody does something? Right. At this rate, the precedent has been set and they are going to continue to operate until somebody stops them. They're going to continue to expand until somebody stops them. But in this moment, there has been no authority, no public institution, no person that has stood in the gap for the people who need them to stand the most. Right. The people in Boxtown are a community of resilient people. They show up. Right. And we have continued to show up at city council meetings. But the most recent votes even show that there is a lack of political will and truthfully a moral compass that helps guide people to make the right decision, even if it's the tough decision. I think we have to examine our relationship to convenience. Right. It is convenient to put it on somebody else. It is convenient to do nothing. But we have to challenge that in order to do something different that protects people for generations to come. We can't only and be solely focused about right now, because the greenhouse gases that are spewing out, the toxins that are spewing out, we know for a fact these toxins contribute to detrimental respiratory issues that we know we are experiencing. I believe we deserve a result that says, a corporation, no matter how big, no matter how small, no matter who's at the helm, but especially if it's a billionaire who is hell-bent on consistently increasing the size of a factory that is choking the lives out of the people in the surrounding area, especially him, we should be saying, how do we slow this down? How do we stop this to make sure that it is something that does not continue this perpetual cycle of environmental racism and environmental injustice? Right. And this is why we have to shift gears in this moment, because we're entering an era of artificial intelligence and development that many people don't even yet understand.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a key part of that, is that this is an attractive proposition for a local government. You can see how the prospect of a billionaire bringing an exciting new factory in can sound good, especially when the local utility says it's no problem. They're going to bring in more money. They're going to invest in utility scale battery storage, which is, you know, kind of a component piece of this. We're at an interesting inflection point with AI and data center growth, but where do you think data centers should be built, if they should be built at all?
So, a little bit of background on me, right? I've got 2 degrees, one in business administration, one in information technology from Old Dominion University, right? And what I understand about both business and technology is that you want to streamline your processes and find the most efficient way to do things. There is nothing efficient about how things are being done here in Southwest Memphis, right? And if you are to move forward data integration or data centers development, you have to start with understanding what it is that is required for your processing. And I think it starts on the ground level with just re-examining the code, right? And examining how much you can scale down before you scale up. Bigger is not always better. And doing more, doing it faster, is more damaging than taking the time to do it right. One of the most prominent AI models is DeepSeek, right? And we know that they didn't use 1 million GPUs. They didn't have to buy 2 million square feet of property and factories and build their own power plant. They didn't. And so it is a different way of imagining, you know, how to move forward the intelligence innovation without the sacrifice of our environment and our health. It's possible, but it does require restraint. It does require guardrails. It does require changing that relationship to convenience. Because it is convenient, because you can do it, doesn't mean you should. Mm-hmm. These are people who are suffocating, right? These are funerals that we're going to. And if the people factor is not included, then we continue to repeat the same cycle. I would just ask that we take just one step backwards to take a more full look at the picture before we continue to move forward in the name of innovation and we continue to crush civilization.
Hmm. Keyshawn Pearson is Executive Director of Memphis Community Against Pollution. Thank you so much for joining us on Climate One.
Thank you. It was a blessing to be here. Thank you all for having me.
We reached out to XAI for comment. They did not respond.
Coming up, some are concerned about how fast AI has infiltrated all parts of our lives, even before we've reckoned with its full impacts.
Think about having hundreds of millions of people playing with these tools without realizing that they're spilling water on the ground or just using energy at the level that they are. That's the challenge here.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Out here, there's no one way of doing things, no unwritten rules, and no shortage of adventure. Because out here, the only requirement is having fun. Bank of America invites kids 6 to 18 to golf with us. For a limited time, sign them up for a free one-year membership, giving them access to discounted tee times at thousands of courses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/golfwithus. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America. Restrictions apply. See bofa.com/golfwithus for complete details. Copyright 2025 Bank of America Corporation.
You know that feeling when someone shows up for you just when you need it most? That's what Uber is all about. Not just a ride or dinner at your door. It's how Uber helps you show up for the moments that matter. Because showing up can turn a tough day around or make a good one even better. Whatever it is, big or small, Uber is on the way. So you can be on yours. Uber, on our way.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This is Climate One. I'm Kusha Navadar.
And I'm Ariana Brocious.
The debut of ChatGPT in late 2022 felt like a huge leap in the human computing journey. And even as we've seen how power-hungry the technology can be, AI is not going away.
The U.S. Department of Energy estimates that data center power demands will double or even triple in just the next 3 years. We also need huge amounts of water to keep all those servers cool. So what can we do to reduce AI's environmental impact?
It's an important question, and our co-host Greg Dalton explored it with two guests in a recent live conversation at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Joining him on stage were Arina Raiku, director of the Internet Ethics Program at Santa Clara University, and also Kate Brandt, the chief sustainability officer for Google.
Kate, for my first question to you, I uploaded Google's 2024 sustainability report to Google's AI tool called Notebook, and I asked it what I should ask you. So here's what it generated. Given Google's ambitious goal to reach net zero emissions across all operations by 2030, and the nearly 50% increase in total GHG emissions the last 4 years, what are you going to do to reverse this trend and ensure the achievement of this critical net zero target?
Yes. Well, the way that we look at this topic as an innovation and an information company and AI first company is that we really need to approach AI both boldly and responsibly. So when we look at our own operational footprint, you know, as a global company, we're operating data centers around the world that are powering AI and all of our products. And we have a value chain that enables the hardware for those data centers as well as for our consumer hardware devices. So that footprint number that you're looking at is towards a very ambitious goal that we've set for ourselves for 2030, which is that we want to be net zero across that whole operations and value chain from a 2019 baseline. And as you can imagine, as a high growth business, our business looks quite different today than it did in 2019. So the way that we're getting after those reductions is predominantly around clean energy, both clean energy for Google, for our own operations, as well as supporting our value chain, our suppliers that are manufacturing semiconductors, hardware for data centers, hardware for cell phones and other devices to decarbonize their manufacturing processes. So that's the biggest lever for us. But then it's also low carbon building materials for data centers. It's the utilization of sustainable aviation fuels. And then after we do all of that work to reduce our footprint, we're also going to purchase carbon removals that will actually remove carbon from the atmosphere. So it's an ambitious goal. We have a lot of work left to do, but we also have a strategy. And we think that strategy is important not only for us to reduce our own footprint, but to be early adopters of things like geothermal power, advanced nuclear power, carbon removal solutions that will have the ability to scale and reduce emissions in a wider economy way.
Because broadly speaking, within tech, there's real concern that Microsoft was going to erase emissions from the history of the company. Google, I think, has been early on this from the early days of renewable energy, cheaper than coal, a long time. But the energy demands of AI are really putting at risk a lot of big tech's sustainability pledges and promises because it's juicing profits and the resource needs are enormous. And so is it fair to say that AI is really threatening sustainability pledges and goals?
We remain absolutely committed to our goals. And I think it's good to level set a bit on where are we today. So if you look at all global data centers today, so that's powering AI and everything else that data centers operate, it's about 1% of global electricity use, between 5 to 15% of overall economic output. So a pretty efficient use of electricity per economic output. Now, if you look at a lot of studies that come out recently, in the US, for example, one of the more recent studies pointed to by 2035, data centers would represent about 20 to 25% of load growth in the US. That's about half of what we would see from electric vehicles. So absolutely, AI load growth is a critical topic. It's absolutely important that we're looking at how do we make model training more efficient? How do we make AI hardware more efficient? And then how do we bring more carbon-free energy, more clean, firm power onto grids to power that load?
Can I jump in for one second in terms of the energy uses? Because the computing power required to power all of this is doubling between 100 days and 6 months. This is what we're talking about. I mean, we're talking massive, very rapid growth. And that's mostly for the training of models. In terms of inference, which is the actual processing every time you run one of the generative AI, for example, Google itself has said that the energy required is going to grow by orders of magnitude. So it's not just that it's growing at such a rapid pace that we are not able to keep up with it. And Gartner Research came out in November with a study that said that AI data centers are going to be restricted in terms of their power by 2027. So that's in 2 years. We're not only running into long-term issues, but short-term issues where even the data centers themselves won't have the power required. So I think a conversation about why we're putting AI into everything so quickly is part of what's needed here.
Yeah, even I think Sam Altman has commented like the amount of energy needed is kind of mind-blowing to do this stuff. So Kate, are we
let's get into it because I think there's a lot of really specific work that we're doing and of course that you're seeing across the industry, but I think where we're seeing a lot of progress is on efficient model training. So as you noted, that's a really important area. So we published an academic journal article not long ago that looked at ways that we're reducing the energy requirements for AI by 100x, the emissions by up to 1,000x through specific techniques and how we can more efficiently do our training. When you also look at AI hardware, each generation, the hardware is getting significantly more efficient. So our custom AI chips are called TPUs, tensor processing units. From one generation, from the fifth generation to the sixth generation alone, they got 67% more efficient. And again, I think what you're seeing here, as we've seen in the data center industry for many years, is strong alignment between the business outcome, which is to do the work more efficiently, and the environmental outcome. And you may know John Kumi, who's a professor at Stanford, who's been very preeminent in the space. He looked at this period of time from 2010 to 2018, when the internet was growing significantly, when data centers were growing significantly. In that time, capacity increased by 550% and electricity only by 6%. Now, I'm not saying I predict that to be the same case here, but it's just good to look at this as a sector where the environmental reductions and efficiency is actually quite business aligned. And then it's about the carbon-free energy. And as you point out, there's a lot of conversation right now around capacity. One thing I would point out is the best thing we can do for ourselves in the near term is better utilize the electricity we already have on the grid. That is going to be our most near-term solution. We've done a lot of work at Google to look at how can we do load shifting in both time and space, so to times of day when the grid is cleaner or to locations where there's more capacity.
So train the models at night when there's a lot of electricity or during the day when there's excess solar and California is actually exporting it to other states.
Indeed. So looking at that flexibility. And again, for us, although AI is a growing part of our data center workloads, there's a lot of work happening in our data centers around storage, around photos, around other activities that can be delayed by some period of time. Some of the work has to be done immediately. Some of it doesn't. So again, it's looking at how do we more effectively use the electrons we have? And then how do we use this to continue to drive a renaissance of of clean, firm energy. You know, we signed a first-of-a-kind agreement with Fervo, which is an advanced geothermal company, getting a first-of-a-kind advanced geothermal power plant online in Nevada to power some of our operations there. We signed a first-of-a-kind power purchase agreement with Kairos Power for 500 megawatts of new, clean, firm power, looking to 2030 and beyond. So again, I think this is also an opportunity to get more clean, firm energy resources onto the grid in this moment of load growth.
And by firm, you mean like reliable, not intermittent, like wind and solar. So but if Google has a choice between signing a data center where energy is clean or it's cheap, cheap wins, right?
So we have a commitment that by 2030, we want to power all of our operations across the globe on 24/7 carbon-free energy. We're 64% of the way there in spite of continuing to really grow significantly as a business. We have multiple sites that are already up at 90%. And so that is something that is a moonshot. We like to say we like hard problems at Google. This is a very challenging aspiration that we've set for ourselves. And because we have this bold aspiration, it pushes us to innovate. It pushes us to get creative. And of course, that's good for the whole sector because we want to be driving towards these solutions that can scale and be cost effective for everyone.
You're right that it's aligned with business incentives in some ways. But to your broader question about whether we're smart enough to answer this, I think we're smart enough. I don't think we're committed enough because the level of financing that goes into deploying AI right now is not matched by the kinds of projects that companies are doing with vulnerable communities or with replenishing water. It's at a different scale. And you see researchers like, I've been meaning to express my gratitude to Dr. Sasha Lucioni and Xiaolei Ren and Emma Strubel, who've talked about, you know, the need to educate the public and lawmakers and everybody about the energy impact and about the water needs, because the companies are not right now stepping up enough to counter these effects.
Right. Well, Arina, you know, you're the ethicist. Markets are amoral, right? And their primary function of publicly listed companies are to generate profits and return capital to shareholders. Isn't it, you know, foolish to expect companies whose primary purpose is to generate profits to do anything other than maximize those profits?
Right. We shouldn't rely on them. We should rely on lawmakers to put the brakes on some of these efforts. We should rely on consumers being educated so they can actually make choices about what products they want to use and what they don't. And right now, without more disclosure for the companies, it's hard to make any ethical decisions, right? You can't balance the benefits versus harms if you don't know what the harms are. And most people are still really surprised when they hear the kind of numbers that we're talking about here. It hasn't seeped into the general consciousness. And often lawmakers are enticed to bring in data centers into their areas because they bring certain benefits with them. The whole discussion that needs to happen around the environmental impact has followed very late compared to all of the promises and the hype that came first.
Well, I mean, until ChatGPT, most people kind of thought AI was this futuristic thing. It exploded pretty quickly. Let's pick up, Kate, on disclosure. Several bills were introduced in the California legislature this year calling for companies operating large data centers to disclose how much energy they use and protect ratepayers from cost increases caused by these giant facilities. There is concern that this demand is, is pushing costs onto an average person. So where do you stand on disclosure and protecting average citizens from price pressure on their utility bills?
Yeah, indeed. I think disclosure is absolutely the baseline for any corporate sustainability program. We've been reporting our corporate greenhouse gas footprint for 19 years to the CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project. We've published a very detailed environmental report for the last 10 years. We'll be publishing our 10th one this summer. And that's where we detail our overall emissions, how we're doing towards our goals on carbon-free energy, our water replenishment program. We haven't gotten into water yet. We have a goal to replenish 120% of the water we consume. We actually just shared our progress on that for World Water Day. So absolutely, disclosure is essential.
You mentioned water. Arena, water is used to cool data centers. Most people have never been inside one, but they're just massive racks of huge servers creating lots of heat that needs to be cooled. Could you explain the water requirements and potential conflicts with local communities, especially in water-stressed regions?
I really appreciate the report that Google puts out because I read it as well. And
I didn't read it. I just asked the AI.
I did read it, and it makes some.
You're a better human than I.
So, it makes some excellent points about all of the things that Google is doing, but it also points out that even in 2023, which is the last year that is covered by the 24 report, 15% of the water usage came from water scarcity areas.
Yeah.
And the global greenhouse gases emissions increased, and the energy requirements increased. Mm-hmm. So even as all this work is happening that we are talking about, the environmental impact so far is only growing. And, you know, I don't mean at all to pick on Google. Google is one example, but there are many companies all in the same boat, all of which are using more energy and more water for their data centers.
So, Kate, your company, Google, has faced pushback over water usage in drought-prone areas like Arizona, South Carolina, and Oregon. So how do you address it? I know you've made this pledge to replenish, but you're only 1/6 of the way there.
And we just shared more progress over the weekend, actually, that I can tell you about.
Okay, so you're more than 18% there. So.
Yeah, indeed. And I really appreciate the nuances that you're raising around what we think of as climate conscious cooling. So there is a trade-off between energy efficiency and the use of water-based cooling. And so in every site that we go to, we look at that trade-off. And so sometimes the option is to find non-potable water sources. We use gray water, seawater, canal water, a whole variety of non-potable water sources at data centers around the world. We also have data centers that don't use water-based cooling where we just decide to make that trade-off to take a small hit on energy consumption because it doesn't make sense to use water in that location. So that's how we're approaching it on a site-specific basis because, as we know, in some places water is plentiful and this isn't an issue. In some places, as you point out, water is stressed and then we need to take a different approach. So that's kind of the first order work that we do. And then beyond that, we've said we want to replenish 120% of the water that we consume by 2030. And for World Water Day on Saturday, we shared we've now been able to replenish 4.5 billion gallons of water through projects around the world. A lot of the more recent ones that we shared updates on are around agriculture. How do we support farmers from California to France to Chile in different irrigation practices? We've also done a lot of work around nature-based solutions. As we know, nature-based solutions enable us to better recharge groundwater, to replenish water that's been depleted. So we're doing these projects globally. That 4.5 billion gallons is compared to the 6.1 billion gallons that we used in 2023. So we're making progress. We need to keep scaling towards that 120% replenishment.
But as of 2023, you're only replenished 18%. So got a long ways to go to get to 120% in 7 years.
Not just that, but the kind of deployment that we've seen since 2023, right? 2024 was a year with a lot of deployment of AI in all kinds of contexts. So the situation might be very different, again, even with the best efforts. And I feel like we're doing a little bit of a disservice by talking about AI broadly as if it's one thing. Because first of all, we need AI to even assess climate impact, to crunch all the vast data sets and to understand what's happening. So AI is extremely important in the climate fight. But different kinds of AI have different environmental footprints. And generative AI, which is the hot stuff that everybody's been talking about since ChatGPT came out, is the one that has by far the biggest environmental impact and the biggest demands. And those models that are being deployed are growing in size, and they're being deployed, again, at a massive scale where we're talking about hundreds of millions of users playing with these right now free tools often and having some that they're paying for. And even within generative AI, the impact of producing images, for example, is very different than the impact from producing text. And there's been research that says producing one or two AI-generated images takes up the equivalent of charging your phone, that having a 10 to 50 prompt conversation with a chatbot is the equivalent of using half a liter of drinking water. So if you think about having hundreds of millions of people playing with these tools without realizing that they're spilling water on the ground or just using energy at the level that they are, that's the challenge here. And this is why now that we're talking more because of laws coming up in Europe about things like AI literacy, We need AI literacy, and we need AI literacy to include a conversation about the environmental impact. That's something I haven't seen yet. Even when we talk about ethical issues around AI, you often hear about bias, you hear about copyright issues and privacy and all the concerns, but often the environmental impact is still flying under the radar.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear how Google is using AI to advance global climate goals.
Using AI to understand traffic patterns, the grading of roads, and a variety of other factors. That's already enabled our users to avoid 2.9 million metric tons of CO2e. That's like taking 650,000 vehicles off the road.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
As a contractor, I don't pay for materials I don't use. So why would I pay for stuff I don't need in my mobile plan? That's why the new My Biz plan from Verizon Business is so perfect. Now I can choose exactly what I want, and I only pay for what I need.
Right now, with My Biz plan, get our best price, as low as $25 a line. Visit Verizon.com/business to get started today.
Price per month with 5+ lines. Includes auto pay and paper-free billing and special intro offer discounts. Taxes, fees, economic adjustment charge, and terms apply. Offers end June 10th, 2025.
Nordstrom brings you the season's most wanted brands. Skims, Mango, Free People, and Princess Polly, all under $100. From trending sneakers to beauty must-haves, we've curated the styles you'll wear on repeat this spring. Free shipping, free returns, and in-store pickup make it easier than ever. Shop now in stores and at Nordstrom.com.
I think you're on mute.
Workday's starting to sound the same.
I think you're on mute.
Find something that sounds better for your career on LinkedIn. With LinkedIn Job Collections, you can browse curated collections by relevant industries and benefits, like flex PTO or hybrid workplaces, so you can find the right job for you. Get started at linkedin.com/jobs. Finding where you fit. LinkedIn knows how.
This is Climate One. I'm Kusha Navidar. Let's return to the conversation Greg Dalton recently hosted at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, diving into the climate harms and benefits of AI. Joining him on stage were Kate Brandt, the Chief Sustainability Officer for Google, and Irina Raiku, the Director of the Internet Ethics Program at Santa Clara University.
Every time we send an email, there's like a puff of energy somewhere. Kate, with the power that Google has to educate people, it seems like there's a tremendous opportunity, perhaps responsibility for Google to pair awareness with these cool new tools. So when we're like, oh gosh, I didn't know that I just burned a liter of drinking water with my little, I wonder what ChatGPT will say for this.
Yeah, indeed. I think this is something that we're having a conversation around. And it is tremendously challenging because as you look at how a data center functions, it's operating many different tools and products and services. So sort of aggregating and segregating out exactly that number is more challenging than you think. But it's absolutely something we're working on. And I think it's something that would be interesting to share more around.
But I want to come back to the kind of the positive impacts of, you know, AI, thank you, Irina, is not one thing.
Yeah.
There's many different kinds, and you know, training models is where the real energy is used. Kate, what are some areas where AI can be used to, you know, deforestation,
yes,
traffic
absolutely,
routing, et cetera? You know, there's some very powerful tools.
Yeah.
On the one hand, it's making the climate crisis worse. On the other hand, it can help us address it.
Yes, and we see a huge opportunity for this, so much so that we've set an aspiration for ourselves that we want to enable businesses, policymakers, individuals to avoid a gigaton of emissions by 2030 through AI and all of our platforms. That's like the emissions of Japan.
Thank you, because I don't know. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
That means,
so that's a very ambitious aspiration. And so we've really gone deep on particularly energy as a sector and transportation as a sector, where we need to see decarbonization and where AI can be a really useful tool. So for instance, we have Google Maps. Some of you may have used Google Maps to get here this evening. There is a little green leaf icon in Google Maps that is showing you the most fuel efficient route, which we've calculated in the background using AI to understand traffic patterns, the grading of roads, and a variety of other factors. That's already enabled our users to avoid 2.9 million metric tons of CO2e. That's like taking 650,000 vehicles off the road. We've also been working with cities to help them better sequence their traffic lights. This is really powerful because it reduces starting and stopping events. And when a car is idling at an intersection, it's 69x the emissions of when it's on the open road. So we're able to reduce those starting and stopping events by 30% and emissions by 10% just by working with cities to do better sequencing of their traffic lights. We've also been working with aviation, commercial aviation. We talk about this as a very hard to abate sector. It represents about 3% of global emissions. Well, a third of that 3%, according to the IPCC, is from contrails, those plumes that you see behind jets. We have been working with American Airlines and Breakthrough Energy to use AI to better understand why are they forming. It turns out it's about time of day and temperature and altitude, and then to work with pilots to make small adjustments in their altitude to reduce those contrails. We've already shown that you can do that by more than half, by 54% in these 77 test flights that we ran with American. So these are the kinds of solutions that we're seeing that can be extremely powerful, that can drive emissions reductions across these hard to abate sectors, and much more to come. We're looking at agriculture, nature-based solutions. It's going to be a really powerful tool. You mentioned the foundational science, climate modeling, also a very powerful application for AI.
So many uses of this, Arena, and yet I have a hard time measuring all
let
those.
Me jump in, because those are all very powerful and wonderful uses, but I think that's when you get the critics saying that we're boiling the oceans in order to summarize emails, right? That's a very different kind of generative AI than the kind of uses that we were just talking about. So, you know, do we need all the chatbot interfaces in every aspect of our lives right now? That's the kind of thing that uses a lot of energy and potentially with a lot less return value.
So is there an ethical framework you think society ought to be using to evaluate all these competing goods and bads?
I don't think we can have a society-wide ethical framework. I think this is a conversation that needs to be much more contextual, and it depends on the particular kind of industry and the particular kind of AI used and, you know, the location. There are just too many factors to apply one framework. But what I will say is that we as the non-scientists and non-business people, to have choices. And in order to make ethical choices, we need the information in the first place. And to your point, I mean, to be fair, I don't mean, again, to put it just on Google. I think all of these companies have a role to play where they could actually provide a lot more information so that people can apply their own ethical framework depending on, you know, their own values and the choices that they're making. And so we don't have enough information to do that. And we don't have enough choice at the design level. For example, right now, if you want to do a Google search, you can't choose, as far as I know, to turn off the AI overviews. I think that would be a really interesting place to allow people to make choices. If they feel that that's something that they value and that they prefer, they should be able to use it. But right now, there are these deployments at scale on all of us where we don't really get to have that kind of input.
So, Arena, you mentioned individual companies would have their own frameworks, but, you know, the internet is minimally regulated. Pharmaceutical company needs all sorts of approvals before they put a product on the market. Tech companies do not. You know, they can roll out social media tools that, you know, damage girls' brains, and, you know, and then we have to kind of play catch up. Now comes along AI, moving very fast. Policy leaders don't understand it. The public doesn't understand it. It's moving like wicked fast, even for Silicon Valley standards fast. So will voluntary action restraint be sufficient by these individual companies? We're all competing against each other. Well, if we don't do it, they're going to do it. And if Americans don't do it, China's going to do it. So let's do it.
Right. No, I don't think it will be sufficient. I think we need lawmakers. And again, I think we need lawmakers who themselves are better informed.
Because right now they're pretty clueless.
Well, I mean, I think it's a difficult, you know, it's a new technology, and then they're supposed to know everything about everything. So yeah. What I would say is that I think lawmakers need to assign staff people who will keep track specifically of AI-related issues, because it's that important right now. I think there needs to be a lot more education. And I think lawmakers have an opportunity to engage with academics in their own areas, in their own states, and in their own cities, who have very different incentives than the business folks do. Right now, the business technologists are the ones who are being heard. But there are a lot of AI researchers who are working in academia who could be fountains of information for lawmakers who are looking to draft better laws. And I do think we need some laws. And I think, whether I think so or not, they're coming. And they're coming at the state level. And they're coming pretty fast. And not just from California, but from many different states. So companies are going to have to comply with some new laws in the near future.
Google's also invested in carbon offsets, kind of a murky area. Some people think that they're a scam. I buy them sometimes. I kind of hold my nose. They're better than nothing, but not fully what they proclaim. Mm. What's your position on offsets? Because they're mm-hmm. very controversial and complicated.
So today where we are is we talked a while ago about our net zero goal, that we have this ambition to reduce our footprint 50% from 2019, and then to manage the rest with both nature-based and technology-based carbon removals. So this is a particular form of carbon credit that's about actually removing carbon from the atmosphere, which the IPCC tells us we need to do both to stay on some trajectory towards the Paris Agreement. We need to do both. We need to both dramatically reduce emissions and remove carbon from the atmosphere. So we see it as being a positive thing for us to be early investors in that space, to be sending a demand signal, because these technologies have to be developed for the science. So for instance, we've done work around advanced rock weathering. We signed an agreement at the end of last year with a company called Teradot. Advanced rock weathering is using basalt to put into soil to more quickly absorb carbon. It's a natural process that would occur much more slowly, but you can add it to soil to enable more carbon to be removed from the atmosphere. We've also looked at similar strategies that can be done in water. We've looked at reforestation projects. We've also done work around using direct air capture to remove carbon from the atmosphere. So it's going to take a portfolio approach. This is a fairly new area. And what we see is that we can be an early adopter. We've now joined advanced market commitments called Frontier, as well as Symbiosis, which are focused on either 1,000-year permanence, so more technology-oriented removals, or more nature-based removals, to really try to advance the science and bring these technologies forward more quickly. So we think it's an important part of the work, and the science really backs that up.
Irina, some people would say that direct capture, these sorts of technologies Kate just mentioned, create a moral hazard because they can allow us to keep burning fossil fuels. It sort of enables us the status quo to continue. Like we can, it's kind of like a little bit like putting a filter on a cigarette. We can keep smoking, we'll just put a filter on it.
But they don't even do that, because with all of the efforts that we're talking about, again, we're seeing greenhouse gas emissions increasing year over year. We're seeing water being used more and more. We're seeing the demand for electricity going up again, doubling every 100 days just to train the models. And then the inference cost is actually much higher. The World Economic Forum estimated that about 20% of the energy use goes to training models and 80% goes to inference, to just the fact that we're all playing with these tools all
inferences
the time.
Inferences means we're using them.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Generating an image, generating, you know, putting in a prompt and getting some response, all of those are called inferences. So at this scale, you're talking about sort of greenwashing, but even the greenwashing is not keeping up, if that's what it is. Again, these are very real efforts, and I think we should embrace all of them and encourage all of the companies to keep doing them. But I think we have to talk at some point about slowing down the deployment and allowing people to make more choices and figuring out where this really belongs and where the energy use and the water use is worth it and where it's not.
Okay, so Irina, you know, everything you've heard Kate say this evening, what did you hear that you most agree with? Where's their common ground?
I agree that there's a lot of opportunity, and I think that the companies are trying to take it. But I think, again, the level of investment that we see in deploying these tools is not being matched by the level of investment in the kind of efforts that Kate is talking about. And I think that's what we should be demanding. There should be an equal number of dollars going into green energy and all of the things that she mentioned.
Kate, of all the things that Irina mentioned, what do you have most common ground, most agree with?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I mentioned at the outset, we as a company are really committed to developing our AI in a both bold and responsible way. And I think all the issues you're raising are very near and dear to my heart and to our heart. How do we make AI as efficient as possible, both from a training and a hardware perspective? How do we bring as much carbon-free energy online as possible, have a thoughtful approach to water that evaluates water stress, the trade-off between water and energy, replenishes the water that we need to consume? Working with academics, I really appreciate what you were saying. saying about policymakers and frankly companies. We do a lot of work with academic institutions because you all are at the forefront of helping us think through this. So I really value the work that you're doing, that academics are doing to help us think through this. And again, to be as bold and responsible as possible.
Kate and Arena, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. Let's give them a big round of applause for us.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Talking about climate can be hard and exciting and interesting. And it's critical to address the transitions we need to make in all parts of society. Please help us get people talking more about climate by giving us a rating or a review. You can do it right now on your device, even if it's 10 years old like Ariana. Or consider joining us on Patreon and supporting the show that way.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, Kusha Navadar, Kevin Lemons, and Ben Testani. Our theme music is by George Young. I'm Ariana Brocious. Thanks for listening.